Inaccurate. Does not compute.
Tech wreck.
Electronic.
Tech wreck.
Yeah, and for Tech Wreck, we are always joined in our Sydney studios by Still Garion. G'day, Still.
G'day, Jamie. Good afternoon.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well today, thank you. We've just had a magnificent thunderstorm in Sydney.
Really? Looking spectacular?
Parts of the city, anyway. I was coming down from the Blue Mountains at the time, and it was big while it was up there. Oh, yes, very grey, very loud, very flashy.
Okay, fantastic. Maybe
loud
a new
flashy, that's Sydney, really, isn't it?
It's got it in a nutshell. Hey, today you've been looking at some rather, well, interesting things regarding the Sony hacking, because it's all we've really been hearing about for a few days now. The threats over a film that was, well, portraying Kim Jong-un, and some threats surrounding that, and that movie obviously now not going to be ahead on its launch date. Was it around Christmas Day?
Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Christmas Day, yes.
The last thing we're kind of hearing about it was the phrase cyber war that's been thrown about. Has that been kind of accurate?
No, in a word. Look, it's a war in a metaphorical sense, like the war on drugs or the war on obesity or something like that. I'm influenced a lot by a chap called Thomas Ridd, who's a war studies chap at King's College, I think it is, in London, but certainly he does this for a living. And he said, look, us people who do war studies, it doesn't count as a war until there's 1,000 deaths.
Okay.
So he said, look, certainly there have been things like the damage to Iran's nuclear facilities and some others, which you'd call cyber sabotage because they damaged equipment. But, you know, the rules of law, you know, this doesn't really come under the heading of an act of war. But it's certainly an interesting attack. It's one of the biggest releases of confidential corporate data that the world has ever seen. I mean, a number of people are comparing it to Edward Snowden's release of information from the National Security Agency. Different topic, of course.
Yeah.
But it's still information that they wanted kept private. And that this is very damaging to the organisation. And for Sony, this is bad. I mean, they had a big data breach the other year when the Sony PlayStation network, the gaming network, was compromised. And it was in the order of a couple hundred million dollars on their bottom line in terms of cleaning up the mess and so on. This one could be very bad indeed. And the people who are claiming responsibility are hinting that there's an even bigger revelation to come. But we've already seen, you know, senior staff's home addresses, their credit card numbers, their last evaluation report, so their confidential assessments. Then movie stars, we're seeing the aliases that they book into hotels under. We're seeing their home details, you know, who's authorised to do what on behalf of the stars. And as each day goes by, there's just more and more amazing stuff coming out of this.
Does it surprise you, though, that a company that big can have that information at risk and hacked?
I'd like to say yes, but
it doesn't, does it? It doesn't surprise you.
No, there are just some companies that have very bad practices. And although we don't know in detail Sony's background on this and specifically what they were doing, we do know that for the entirety of Sony Pictures, they had 11 people working on information security. 9 of them were managers and 3 of them were workers. There was even like a vice president there who didn't have any information security background. He was from a marketing background. So, you know, they got a big wake-up call, as the cliche goes, when the PlayStation network was hacked. And now this is just phenomenal. We've got arguments about whether it really is North Korea or whether it's someone pretending to be North Korea to distract from the real perpetrator. There's a lot more to come on this story.
So this is more of a story about poor practices by a major company rather than what the increased hacking power of individuals?
Look, it's a bit of an arms race all along. I mean, the bad guys are getting cleverer and cleverer about getting in, and the defenders are constantly learning and becoming more sophisticated in their defences. The old adage is, though, that the defenders have to get it right every single time, whereas the attackers only have to get it right once.
Yeah, that's a good point to remember.
They just have to find the one thing that you missed, and they're in. I'm starting to get the feel around the information security community that the good guys are falling behind a bit. And one of the people who is the chief security officer for Cisco, a major network equipment company, he estimates that by 2020 we'll have a shortage of about 1 million trained people in information security amongst, you know, corporations and governments worldwide. We'll have to have some sort of massive campaign of educating new recruits, and then, like any new recruits in an army, are they going to be any good?
Yeah, good question. 22 minutes to three. Stilgherrian is my guest, and we're talking technology today. One part of this story still that I found fairly interesting as well, that there were, because of this, there were days where Sony staff found themselves without a computer.
It was a couple of weeks.
It's even worse.
It kicked off Monday morning, and it was the short week before the Thanksgiving holiday in the US. 8:15 in the morning, every computer in the entire organisation, the screen goes black and comes up with a warning message saying you've been attacked. And they had to shut down the whole network to disinfect it, as it were, to find out what had got in there and to get rid of it. And they were without computers for more than a week before they even started to get a handle on how big the problem was. And it was only Monday or Tuesday of the second week that staff were being told, hey, you really should go and cancel your credit card numbers and change the passwords on every single thing you've got, and maybe change your bank account numbers and maybe talk to your mortgage broker, and on. All of their private information had been revealed, or stolen at least, and was going to come out somewhere. So here they were trying to run a modern a business. I mean, you have a computer on every desk in a business these days. You have voicemail. They didn't have voicemail. They barely had email. So when they needed to send a document to someone, they had to print it and like walk it over to them, except then where were all the printers? So they're used to emailing them. So people talked to each other more. It increased the socialization in the office for a period. And I suppose that helped deal with just the stress of working under such unusual circumstances. But they found so many things that it got wrong. There were sort of important files that hadn't been stored on a backup anywhere, so important financial spreadsheets had to be recreated from scratch, or the templates for a standard contract or something like that. And this kind of thing really does hit an organisation. I know that in the small business area, there was this adage that if you had a complete loss of all of your stored data, then there was a 30% chance your business would be wound up within the next 6 months or some such figure.
I wonder if they can put a figure on what it cost them. Just the cost of not having, in terms of a lack of productivity, not having your computer for that long.
Well, you can. I mean, you can absolutely estimate that. You just multiply everyone's salary and on costs and the insurance and rent and whatever for keeping that whole organisation in place and not producing anything.
Hey, the other interesting thing that you mentioned about that as well is there might have been actually some better social aspects to the company. There might have been a situation where Bob in marketing actually found out who Rod in operations was, because instead of just flicking him an email, he was walking over to him.
Oh, you do have in big corporations these days the sense that it is really quite faceless. Everyone's just a button on your telephone or an email address. And I was struck by that only this afternoon, where the financial people for one of the media outlets I write for, they're in Singapore. I've never met them.
Yeah.
I don't know whether the financial controller, well, I know she's a woman from her name, is she young or old? Is, you know, fat or thin, tall or short, angry or happy, you know?
And I figure if you start asking her those questions, you might not be writing for them anytime soon.
Yeah, see, it's a bit wrong, isn't it?
So it's a little bit wrong. It's a little bit wrong. How do you think you'd function without your computer for a couple of weeks?
Can't be done.
Can't be done?
I mean, it is my tool of trade. Not only it's the tool that I do all my writing and communication on, it's the tool for research as well. And when I had to send my laptop in for repair a while back and it was away for 5 days or something, I mean, I could switch to working off a phone, but it's really hard to write 2,000 words in a hurry on a tiny little keyboard. It's really hard to spread out information on a screen and absorb it and read it comfortably. And things that I couldn't do were, well, edit audio for a podcast, and suddenly, how am I going to do that? I could do it on a smaller device, and it's going to take 5 times as long. there goes the morning.
Yeah, I don't think your thumbs would be able to keep up with the word count needed still.
No.
18 minutes to three. Jamie Burnett with you on 720 ABC Perth, local radio WA as well. There's so many facets to this Sony story still. One of them as well, I was reading about something called the Streisand effect.
Ah, yes, named after the famous Barbara Streisand.
So it is after Barbara Streisand.
Oh, she caused it.
What is it?
The Streisand effect is where your attempts to hide something or remove it from the public gaze attracts attention to the fact you're trying to hide something, and so everybody immediately wants to know what it is, and everyone will go looking.
Right.
And it's named after her because Barbara Streisand has a house in Malibu on the clifftops looking out over the Pacific Ocean. And there happens to have been a geological study of the coastline of California to photograph it from an aircraft every X years so they could see how the cliffs were eroding under different weather conditions and so on.
Right.
So there's some, I don't know, 12,000 photographs down the whole length of the California coastline, and these were all put online. And Barbara Streisand found out that, of course, in one of the photographs is a picture of her house.
Right.
So she sued them for loss of privacy and cease and desist letters and all of this. Take down the photograph of my house. The thing is, there was nothing in this database to indicate that that was her house. It was just a house. Like all the other houses, I mean, a very big house, but it was just another house on the coast. So, and the photograph had been seen by six people, and two of those people were actually Streisand's lawyers. So she then had to go into court and produce the photograph, and then within a couple of weeks, it's like 12,000 people. No, hang on, where's the number? 420,000 people checked it out over the next month.
So from 6 to 420,000 in her attempts to make herself more private and to take a photo down.
Completely failed.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, an Australian example, I was trying to think of one. Chris Kenny's famous dog-related sketch on The Chaser.
Yes, and I won't play the audio.
No, let's not. But it was on The Chaser, and with all respect to The Chaser crew,
there was a moderate viewing.
It's a moderate viewing. Yeah, it's respectable, but moderate. But as soon as the controversy kicked off, well, everyone said, "What do you mean? There's a photograph of Chris Kenny and a dog as a very close and intimate friend."
Yes. Just had my hand hovering over the delay button then, just to let you know, still, but you're a professional.
Yes, I know. There's things you can't really say at this lovely hour of the afternoon,
no,
is it?
No.
Or even any hour of the day. So, you know, it's just so funny. And we see it again and again in the media that something is published. And this is why it relates to the Sony case. All of these internal documents related to Sony, well, people are linking to them on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever. And then Sony's sending them a takedown notice from their lawyer saying, take this off. And everyone goes, oh, what does Sony not want us to see? Let's go and have a look. It will work against them because they're going to end up playing a game of whack-a-mole as, all right, they do force John Smith to take it off his Twitter account, but Mary Jones will put it up on hers. And
she's retweeted it a thousand
others.
Times. Yeah.
And it just spread out. As someone said of the internet, you can't take the pee out of the pool.
It's a good way to put it still.
Yeah, once it's out there, it's out
once
there.
Once it's there, it's there.
You just have to accept it.
14 minutes to three. And this relates, that theory, I suppose, relates well to some new research that was looking at privacy as well this week. And I suppose it was looking at what privacy means to us now and not into the too distant future as well, how that changes.
Yeah, the Pew Research Project is a fascinating American long-term research project on how the internet is changing American society. And because the internet in the US and the ways it's being used is often a year or two ahead of Australia, maybe not quite 2 years now, but it gives us a bit of a heads up of what's happening. And the discussions here are that privacy could eventually become something that only the wealthy have. Or weird people have. And the reasoning behind that is that we're pouring so much information online in exchange for different things of value that has become now the normal way to pay for stuff is with your private information. I mean, Facebook is the obvious example. Mm-hmm. You don't pay any cash to use it, but you give Facebook the rights to trawl through and analyze all of the hidden details and information of what you happen to post.
Photos and updates and
yeah,
and
they
that.
See yeah. who your friends are mm-hmm. and they can notice in the photos what brands of cars you're interested in and where you've travelled to and all this stuff, which is very, very valuable to advertisers. And increasingly, as we see more of this data being used for other purposes, and we spoke last week about your insurance company might be able to analyse your driving habits of your car once your car is connected yeah. to the internet. Well, what if the deal is you reveal your driving habits, you'll get 20% off your car insurance. If you refuse to reveal your driving habits, then you will be charged the full rate card for your insurance. Now, wealthy people will go, oh, that's a fair deal. I don't want the insurance company knowing about that, and I'm happy to pay the extra
load. Yeah, what's
20%?
Yeah.
What's 20% to me? So, you know, there is a fear amongst some privacy professionals that we will see this kind of two-stream approach to services on the internet, that you can pay to have all your stuff done privately for you, but for most people, it's out in the open. And in a sense, gee, that's a bit like the difference between public transport and a chauffeured limousine, isn't it? I mean, you know, the limo's got tinted windows and you can drive around in privacy, but if you don't have that kind of money, it's up the back of the bus where everyone can see you.
Still, though, it comes down to responsibility as well, and I suppose as consumers, understanding how accessible our stuff is online, is it our responsibility
yeah.
or is it something that falls back and will fall back in the future to governments to take more responsibility with that?
Well, I'm of the view that everyone needs to take some responsibility for their own actions and learn about the world around them. But at the same time, you can't be a specialist in everything. And part of the job of a government, in my view, is to help the population understand the world around them. Because if the government isn't working for the citizens, then it's left up to corporations or criminals or whatever other interest groups to do the education instead. And you know, maybe they don't have the best interests of the individual citizens in mind. That gets into the whole deeply political angle of it. But, you know, we do, at the very least, need to think up new social rules about the use of private information. And I was struck in reverse by this thought. An American internet engineer who happens to be of Indian descent, he grew up in a remote Indian village before his family moved to the United States and so on. He said, Privacy is a kind of Western middle class thing. You grew up in an Indian village. There is no privacy. Everyone's in a mud building. There's no glass in the windows. And if it's 8 o'clock at night and the father is berating his daughter for going out with that lad down the road and how dare she, and she, you know, everyone can hear it. There is no privacy. A lot of the rules of privacy came when the cities grew during the Industrial Revolution, and you suddenly had more and more people jammed closer and closer together. So as a society, we developed rules of behaviour. We learnt when to keep the doors closed, when to avert our eyes, when not to talk about something we might have overheard, because that was a breach of the social contract to make it all just a little bit more comfortable for us to live with each other and not remembering what we heard them say during their argument next door last night. We do have this thing, though, another one that strikes me is that increasingly we are being required to identify ourselves for perfectly mundane transactions, like every financial transaction online, because it happens through a digital credit card transaction that's mediated by a bank. So we have to identify ourselves for that. In the offline world, in the analog world, the default is you don't identify yourself. I can buy a hamburger every day from that shop down the road from where I work. They don't know my name. They don't know where I live. They just know that I don't look violent. I don't look like I'm going to steal their hamburgers. And I don't know who they are. I just see that the shop looks reasonably clean and they're not trying to poison me. And we don't need to know each other's identity. I was struck once when in a juice shop, you know, you place your order for a juice.
Yeah.
And then they say, can we have your name? I grew up in the country and it. No, you know, who are you? I'm not telling you who I am. And yet their corporate policy, their corporate idea was that, oh, but calling you by your name is friendly. And I said, no, it's not. It's intrusive. It's a different social value. So that's an example of the kinds of ways in which our social values might change. But it's interesting that we haven't, you know, we've got an enormous pressure to constantly identify ourselves on the internet as if that will somehow solve the problems.
And it's a steep learning curve as well still. That's the other thing.
Absolutely. And I often think that we're going to have a generation that stuffs it up before we get a generation that's right.
That understands,
I think the way to think about that, I may have said this before, but we learn the social rules in the playground, in the kindergarten, at our mother's knee, you know, beating up on our brothers and sisters or whatever it might be. So we learn from a very early age what you do and don't do in public. And we've grown up in that, so our own children, we will naturally teach them the rules. The first generation through the internet doesn't know what the rules were because there weren't any. They kind of are working it out themselves, but they make mistakes. So, you know, I suspect we'll have a generation of completely unelectable political candidates because there will always be something in the dirt file. You know, no one will be able to become a kindergarten teacher, any position in anything. Because look what you said back when you were 13 and a half years old. You are a deep-seated racist. There's no way
Still, Gary, and I'm changing my Facebook profile picture as we speak. Thank you for that.
Kittens are safe.
Great to have a chat with you today, and we'll speak to you, in the new year.
No worries, Jamie.
Yeah, still Gary in there, technology writer and commentator, just making sense of, things in the technology world and plenty talking about with the Sony hack as well.